From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a look at Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan's first State of the City address.
After 7 weeks, I'll report this to you here tonight, what I believe for sure. The change has started. The change is real.
You know, I try not to be too optimistic about things because we've all been around too long to really just throw a lot in and say this is going to work. But this is a promising start.
Plus, should a four-year college degree be the goal of our high school grads?
I really do believe that college should be for everyone, but not necessarily at the time that they graduate from high school.
And get ready for changes in what you pay to hunt and fish in Michigan. We find out why.
Hunting and fishing really does fund conservation in Michigan.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Glad you could join us today. Well, we've all heard this time and time again. In today's economy, the more education you get after high school, the better for everyone, right? But what if some students might be happier and better served in other settings, academic or otherwise? Is it time for Michigan to develop some credible alternatives for high school grads? We find out more on today's show. And then we'll speak with Daniel Howes about his latest column looking at Detroit's historic bankruptcy. But first, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan delivered his first State of the City speech last night before a jammed invitation-only crowd. His message was clear. We are going to change what it means to live in Detroit.
After 7 weeks, I'll report this to you here tonight, what I believe for sure. The change has started. The change is real. And Detroit is not nearly as far away from turning around as most people think. Thank you all very much.
Even among those who have that wait-and-see attitude, the mayor's speech is being praised today for what many believe is a refreshing attention to detail and the sense that a team is hard at work. Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Cafford joins us now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Well, before we get into what Mike Duggan talked about, let's talk about how he said it. No teleprompter?
No teleprompter, and I don't think notes either.
That is a 45-minute speech from the heart. Well, he did that speech, in a sense, going to all those home meetings when he was deciding whether to run and kind of doing that stump speech. So he's now in a position to say, we're doing the things I've talked about.
He is, and when you listen to him speak, I heard him speak twice this week at another event and then at the State of the City last night. He goes into a surprising level of detail. He talks about bus routes. He talks about conversations with workers. He talks about conversations with residents. It comes through loud and clear. He seems to really be trying to understand the shape of the government that he's running and trying to understand what people need from it and why it's not meeting those needs.
What struck you the most as far as the tone of Mike Duggan's speech as compared to what you've heard in previous State of the City addresses with Dave Bing and Kwame Kilpatrick?
Well, he talked, first of all, like I said, he talked a lot about people he's talking to and input he's getting, not how he's going to do things and how, you know, I'm going to get this done, but how his team is going to get stuff done and about what people need him to get done. But he also, honestly, just sounds like he's got a lot of enthusiasm for the work, which is a real great thing to hear. It's a very hard job he has, and it's the kind of job, I believe, that if you don't have enthusiasm for it, it's just too hard. You have to love this work and want to excel at it and really have an appetite for it.
What did Duggan say about the elephant in the room, if you will, the presence of an emergency manager who has total control over finances?
He's made no secret about the fact that he would prefer there not be an emergency manager. But, you know, he wants to be mayor of the town. He wants to run the town.
Yeah.
But they have a power-sharing agreement that was put out by the emergency manager's office. The emergency manager is going to run the bankruptcy. The mayor is going to run city services, of course, with the emergency manager's final approval. But, you know, I think it's a good pairing. You have an incredibly experienced, seasoned bankruptcy attorney running the bankruptcy, and you have an experienced government administrator running the city government. This is a good team.
And we saw city council members sitting there at the Irma Henderson Hall last night applauding. I know that, you know, there's political posturing, but there does seem to be a sense, does there not, that he is able to play nice with city council and vice versa at this point?
Well, he's an experienced politician, and, you know, he's not going to make the mistake that some other leaders might make of thinking that they can marginalize city council or work around city council or not court the council. The council is a legislative body of the city of Detroit, and they have a charter mandated function of fiduciary responsibility to examine documents and proposals and cast votes that are in the best interest of the city and of Detroiters. And, you know, anyone who thinks that they can do an end run around the council isn't understanding how the system is meant to work.
So let's go through some of the things that he did cover, because that consistent positive review is, gee, we actually heard some details.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about blight.
Well, he is setting an aggressive blight removal schedule. This money that he's talking about is part of the $520 million that the emergency manager Kevin Orr set out in his plan of adjustment that was sent to the bankruptcy court last week.
Mm-hmm.
But this is money that's specifically from the fire insurance escrow, fire escrow account. This is money that removes burned homes. And that is, I think, a good thing, because there's always going to be debates over where houses need really to be demolished, which houses are too far gone to save. But when they're fire damaged houses, it's a little easier to say, yeah, this one's got to go.
Very true.
So, you know, but clearing up blight, I mean, it is incredibly damaging to the city. These blighted, derelict houses that aren't maintained, that aren't livable, are havens for dumping or for, you know, unlawful activity. Even if they're not dumping and illegal activity going on there, it's just very dispiriting, I think, to live in a neighborhood and be someone who cares about your property and cares about your neighborhood, and to have these persistent problems that you don't have the power to fix, that they're just your environment degrading around you.
He also called on state lawmakers, right, to help out by passing that scrap metal bill.
He did. He's pushing that scrap metal bill hard. It is a bill that would make it more difficult for scrappers to sell the three of the most high-target theft items, which are catalytic converters, copper wire, and air conditioning units.
Mm-hmm.
This bill would make it more difficult for people to sell those pieces, and those are the ones that are targets. Those things that are targets, and they're things. The horrible thing about this, Cindy, is that if someone steals those necessary components out of your air conditioning unit,
mm-hmm.
they may get $20, $50, $100, $200 for them. But it can cost the homeowner or the business owner who's been victimized thousands of dollars to repair this. It's like,
wow.
It's such an awful, destructive thing.
So that is something state lawmakers could do. The other thing it struck me, it reminded me of the line in the movie Gladiator when General Maximus says, "At my signal, unleash hell." And it sounds like the city is going to do that toward negligent landlords.
Yeah, that's another problem, is that there are people, there's so many complicated factors that go into this, because of economic stress, because of the blighted environment generally, it is very easy for people who own property not to maintain them, and it becomes the norm. And even folks who might otherwise feel like they needed to make investments or do maintenance to their property kind of feel like, well, no one's going to call me on it, so why do I need to do this? And so, yeah, he's got a very aggressive plan to force property owners to either improve and secure and their property, or he says they're going to sue to seize those properties and sell them in the tax auction. Now, that's not there's some problems with that, too, in that we have more derelict properties coming into the tax auction every year than we can really handle. But
he's serving notice, though. He's throwing the gauntlet down.
He really is.
And what did he say about just the fact that city services are so dismal? What did he address during the speech last night that gives people hope that he's aware of it and doing something about it?
Well, he's just, you know, he's really, you know, I think his just the ease with which he speaks about, you know, he spoke about a bus route that didn't make sense and how they worked on that. In a speech I heard him give earlier this week, he talked about riding with a snowplow driver who was saying, you know, the way our dispatch is done doesn't make sense. I go out of my way. I could do more streets if we were able to rationalize the system. You know, I think that this level of detail, that he's really following these processes through to find out why they're not working. This is a very hands-on approach.
And he's created the district offices with managers, so at least that brings City Hall closer right into the neighborhoods, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. We've seen neighborhood City Halls before under previous mayors, and they sort of seem to come and go during different administrations. I think it's all going to depend on the implementation of that. It's a really good idea, and with the new district council system in place, hopefully there's some opportunities for the mayor's neighborhood or district offices to coordinate with those district council people and really try to get residents' voices heard, to get their concerns brought to City Hall in a way they can be addressed, because that is, you know, a persistent complaint in Detroit is investment and attention is paid to the developing, comparatively prosperous areas of Midtown and downtown, but the neighborhoods suffer. And those, but yet the neighborhoods are the bulk of Detroit. And so those have to be brought along. These improvements have to happen in the neighborhoods as well.
We also know he talked about EMS and buying more ambulances and asking the federal government for money for more buses. He talked about the M1 and Red Wings Arena as job development. I'm wondering, was there anything that you wished, Nancy, that you'd heard or wished he had said?
Well, you know, I mean, I think he hit a lot of the key points. You know, it's worth remembering that the city's police department continues to report to emergency manager Kevin Oren. Obviously, public safety is the city's most pressing problem. Detroit Public Schools, obviously, also not underneath the mayor's jurisdiction. You know, those are. You know, in the current environment with the emergency manager in place, he can't, you know, he's not in charge of the police department,
right.
So he can't do a lot of stuff there. He's never going to have control of DPS unless we have some major structural change. So two of the biggest issues that affect quality of life in the city and the interest of people in moving here or staying here are kind of out of his control at the moment.
So what will you and your colleagues on the Detroit Free Press editorial board, now that this speech is said and done and out there, what will you be watching for?
Well, we got to see what he does. You know, these relationships are in place. He's working with city council. He's working with the emergency manager. He's very careful to talk about how much he respects the work line-level city workers are doing, which is also huge because I believe that people in the city, most people who work for the city work very hard and they want to do a good job. I mean, they're regular folks just like you and me who come to work every day. But I think that there's a wide perception in this Metro Detroit that folks who work for the city are lazy and they don't do their jobs. It's just not true. And to have the mayor acknowledge that and praise them for the hard work that they do in horrible conditions where they don't have adequate resources, I think that positions him a lot better to get good results out of people. And so, you know, what we'll be watching for is to see how these relationships, whether they're sustainable with workers, with the mayor, or with the emergency manager, with city council, and whether he's able to follow through on these initiatives.
Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Caffer. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, this is the time of the year when a lot of high school juniors are taking their ACTs and scheduling college campus tours, and high school seniors are jumping to the mailbox looking for college acceptance letters and hopefully financial aid packages. There are many in Michigan who believe that this, heading to college, is the key to a successful life. There is a lot of evidence that young adults with that four-year degree will do better in terms of employment and wages than their peers who have some college or a two-year degree or only a high school diploma. But there is another side to this discussion, the one that raises the question, is college truly the right choice for all of our high school grads? And are we overlooking opportunities offered by skilled trades and other careers that don't require that four-year degree? Joining me to explore these questions is Glenda Price. She's the former president of Marygrove College in Detroit, and she is now the president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation. And we welcome back Lou Glazer. He's president of Michigan Future, Inc. Good to have you with us, Lou.
My pleasure.
I want to start with you, Lou. You have been extremely and always consistent in your view that the key to Michigan's economic health and really our nation's depends on how many adults in our workforce have that four-year college degree. Now let's talk about the millennials. What does the data tell us about the ones with that four-year degree versus the ones without?
So there's a terrific new study out by the Pew Research Center, which I really recommend your leaders, your listeners take a look at, which both compares sort of the economic well-being of millennials by education attainment and then compares today's generation, the 25 to 32-year-olds, to those in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion from the research, which actually is somewhat contrary to what's become conventional wisdom, is that those who have a four-year degree or more, these are 25 to 32-year-olds coming out of the worst recession since the Great Depression, are doing better in terms of income than any previous generation of college-educated young people. The gap between them and those who have a two-year degree or high school is growing, and their unemployment rate is lower. So at the moment, you know, if you want a reliable path to the middle class, it is predominantly for those who have four-year degrees or more. It's more true today than it has been ever before.
Glenda Price, your recent column in Bridge Magazine was an interesting take from a past college president because you asked the question, is college the right choice for all high school grads?
Well, and indeed, I have asked that question because of my new position here with the Detroit Public Schools Foundation. I have been looking at K-12 education in a very different way than I have in the past. And one of the things that I am seeing is that, unfortunately, our K-12 educational system is not preparing as many students to go to college as we would like. And as a result, we have a significant number of students who truly are not prepared, and as a result, they attend in many, many instances, and they fail. The six-year graduation rate across the country right now is only 57%. And so when you look at all of those students who are not prepared, you have to ask yourself the question, how can we better serve them? Of course, the easy answer is we have to do something with our K-12 system, and I agree with that. But between now and then, what about all of the students who are graduating high school and are not able to complete a four-year degree?
What do you say to that, Lou?
Yeah, look, I mean, I agree 100% with what Dr. Price just said. The tragedy at the moment is that in an economy which increasingly is requiring people with sort of advanced learning, is that we have a K-12 system that in way too many cases is not preparing kids for that economy. So I think two things are true. One is that we really have to make sure that our K-12 system works for every kid. Period.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But secondly, there clearly are kids who come out of high school today poorly served by the K-12 system, mm-hmm. for whom they really, if they go to college, they're not going to succeed. If they go to a four-year college, they're not going to succeed. For them, we need options. But that's a failure of our K-12 system, not sort of where we want to end up long term.
And I agree with that 100%. We must address the quality of K-12 education so that every student who graduates has the option to go to a four-year college or university if they choose to do so. But I also recognize that even some of those students who are prepared academically are not prepared emotionally. They need some time to grow up. And I really do believe that college should be for everyone, but not necessarily at the time that they graduate from high school.
So give me an idea of the of what you might, and I know in England they do that gap year before they go off, so they do grow up a little bit, do some public service or mm-hmm. some kind of experience.
Well, I have a perfect example in my family that I will use. I have a niece who is academically capable, and at the time that she graduated from high school, she simply was not prepared to go to school. She wanted to cook, and so she went off to a culinary arts program, and she received that certificate. She started working in a restaurant and said, gosh, I don't want to do this the rest of my life, but what I'm really interested in is nutrition. So, you know, after a number of years, she did grow up. She understood that what she really wanted to do was going to require that four-year degree, and so she took the appropriate steps. Had she gone right out of high school, she would not have succeeded. I have no question, doubt in my mind about that.
And that has nothing to do with K through 12 instruction. That's where a youngster's head is at,
sure.
at the point of getting that high school diploma.
Exactly. Sure. And we have to acknowledge that there are students like that, that we need to help make that transition.
Sure. I mean, I continue to be a really big fan of AmeriCorps, you know, and which is this opportunity for people to do community service and earn relatively low wages, but also earn some college tuition as mm-hmm. part of AmeriCorps as sort of this transition year, the kind of story that Dr. Price just told about people going in the workforce first and then figuring out that they want to get a four-year degree is terrific. The key to all of this, though, is that you want a high school education so that doing well in a four-year university is a realistic option for every student. and then let it be their choice whether they pursue it or not. At the moment, what we've ended up doing is in too many cases, we either have a lousy high school education where they're not prepared, or some adult tells the kid in high school, you're not college material, and steers them away.
Soft expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Lou Glazer, president of Michigan Future Incorporated, and with Glenda Price, who's president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation, kind of asking the question, is college the right choice for all high school grads? And, you know, Lou, I noted your recent blog post on the Michigan Future website noted the millennials actually, I was surprised at this, have a higher four-year degree attainment than the previous generations, Gen X, the boomers, and the silence. I've never heard that. They're also known as the greatest generation.
Right.
So they're getting there. But to be fair, we all know there are too many college-educated workers who are making lattes at Starbucks while they are trying to figure out how to use that degree and pay down huge student loans.
Yeah. Yes. Although I think it's way exaggerated. I mean, so what the Pew data says, this is for 25 to 32 year olds, is that even in this lousy economy, the unemployment rate for college four-year degree young professionals is about 3%. Of those who work, 90% have a full-time job, and their average wage is $45,000. The $45,000 corrected for inflation is higher than it was for the boomers, Generation X, or the silence. So they're doing better than previous generations. I mean, we've got this sense that somehow or other, because everybody knows someone at Starbucks that has a college degree, that they're the general rule. It turns out they're not the general rule.
Glenda, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I would agree with that. I'm sure that that is true. Having spent so much time in higher education, I really do believe that having that degree is the ticket, the passport into the middle class for those who are not yet there, or to stay in the middle class in advance for those who are fortunate enough to be born into the middle class. But I come back to continuing to ask the question of how do we transform our K-12 educational system so that every student has options and opportunities when they graduate. Right now, everyone doesn't. It is not an even playing field for entry into college, so that the statistics that Lou has cited are right on. I don't disagree with any of it, but I am concerned that if we continue to send students into college that are not prepared, they will end up in great debt, have a sense of failure when they could be successful in other ways while we're preparing our K-12 system to not allow that to happen into the future.
It's interesting. I'm thinking of emails that I have gotten just here on Stateside from people who listen to conversations we have on this very topic. And you don't have to look real hard to find people who believe that this push for four-year college degrees is more about maybe generating revenue for universities. What's your response to that when you hear that, Lou? I take it you've heard it, too.
Yeah.
And those of us who are in higher education simply laugh.
Right.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, correct. I mean, it's so two things. First of all, I mean, if you really look at the data, their tuition is going up far faster than higher ed expenses are going up. The difference is that the public has decided not to invest in higher education. So, I mean, that's really what's forcing tuition up, is this disinvestment by the public. So when I went to college, 70% of my tuition was paid for by the government. Mainly the state of Michigan. I went here to the University of Michigan. Today, it's like 20%. I mean, it's So it's once again, nobody has to go to college. People are choosing to go to college. That's what's encouraging about the Pew data is that the millennials are not listening to this nonsense about that they would be better off not getting a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. More of them are getting a four-year. So the reason that that's consumer demand, that's exactly what you want.
And Glenda, I guess what I also hear you say is we also do need to Think of these young people who are not equipped, perhaps, to succeed at the four-year degree, but could elsewise. So what other steps and options do you see that could offer that young person a path to a productive life with a decent paycheck?
Well, I think that looking at all of the skilled areas, whether or not it is culinary arts or any of the artistic areas or skilled manufacturing for individuals, there are lots of options. And I think that one of the things that we have to do is to help students to find something where they can begin. And that's the way in which I look at it. It's not the end. I would hope that what we are doing is instilling in everyone a sense of lifelong education. You may begin at this particular place and level, but you will continue to grow. You will continue to have educational options, and you will indeed have the opportunity at some point to go to college to get that degree that is going to catapult you into the next economic level.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I mean, what we always say when we do presentations is that those with a four-year degree are doing best economically. It also is the best predictor of how well the whole community is doing. But getting a two-year degree or occupational certificate is still a good option.
Mm-hmm.
And kids need to understand that, know about it, and once again because their skill level is going up as well, mm-hmm. they also need a good K-12 education to get into a community college and do well.
Absolutely, and some of the skilled areas are requiring an equal level of reading and comprehension ability as college. And so I don't think that we can simply say, well, you know, you don't need as much K-12 education in order to go into one of the skilled trades. You certainly do need it. And so again, it comes back to making sure that it's an option and not a default position.
Interesting battle cry from these lifelong educators. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Lou Glazer of Michigan Future Incorporated, and Glenda Price of the Detroit School Foundation, also former president of Mary Grove College in Detroit. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you. I hope that the conversation continues.
All right, baseball fans, especially you fans of West Michigan's Whitecaps, it's your chance to decide just what treat will be added to the concession menu at Fifth Third Ballpark. The annual online poll lets fans choose their favorite item from ideas submitted by fans. The team has pulled a top 10 list from hundreds of ideas. Mickey Graham is with the West Michigan Whitecaps. So I'm wondering, Mickey, of the 10 that are on there, give me the one that you would say, ooh, I really would like to have that.
Oh, well, I would say the North of the Border Burger, which is a poutine hamburger. It's poutine, which is a gravy and cheese curds and fries.
Canadian.
We're putting it on a hamburger.
That
sounds awesome to me.
I wonder if fans are ready to embrace that Canadian poutine. I have to say, Whitecaps fans had some interesting ideas for the All-American hot dog. Like, hey, let's top that dog with mashed potatoes and gravy.
Yeah, why not?
I guess not.
Why wouldn't you do that?
Now, from the Life is Short, Eat Dessert First department, describe for us the Sleeping Bear Dunes Sunday.
Yeah, that was a suggestion based on the Sleeping Bear Dunes name, the icon in the northern part of the state here.
Yeah.
It's just a huge helmet full of ice cream and topped with Teddy Graham. So it's got, we figure, roughly 10,000 plus calories in it. So that's definitely something for the list.
Well, it seems clear that fans are not concerned about icky little things like fat and sodium grams when they want to go eat at the ballpark, do they?
No, we have a wide variety of food, but you know, hot dogs and hamburgers still are the kings. And you know, I think people come to the ballpark to kind of get away from eating healthy a little bit, and it shows by their suggestions that they send in to us.
Well, fans can vote for the newest addition to the Whitecaps concession stand menu. Go to whitecapsbaseball.com and check out all of these incredibly creative items. And Friday the 7th is the deadline for the voting, and the team opens its 21st season on April 8th. Just promise us winter will be done as we eat our waffle pizza.
Absolutely. You can't have winter and baseball at the same time.
We'll take that. Mickey Graham with the West Michigan Whitecaps. Thanks for talking with us, Mickey.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. Earlier in the show, we talked about Mayor Mike Duggan's first State of the City speech. As Duggan does the heavy lifting to get Detroit actually up on its physical feet, the other part of its rehab is, of course, the historic bankruptcy. So many pieces, so many players. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been keeping a close eye on all of it. Daniel, the clock is ticking loudly, isn't it? Because Kevin Orr has only until September before his term is over, and there's an incredibly complex puzzle to assemble before then.
Yeah, and everybody's kind of sitting, all the constituencies are sitting back on their haunches and waiting for somebody else to make the first move, and nobody's moving.
Yeah, it's like a big game of chicken, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And the thing that I think is important this week is that bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes pretty much said, listen, we're going to keep this thing on the fast track. So for those of you that are asking for more time, you've had enough time, let's keep moving. And so I think we're going to start to see some resolution. But there's some really big things hanging out there, starting with the enact of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of this, how this deal ultimately goes down, depends upon this very large $815 million fund that's been pulled together by foundations and DIA benefactors and a $350 million pledge from the state. But state legislators are suggesting that they're not going to support this. And if they don't, the whole thing collapses on itself. And there's very much a feeling within Kevin Orr's team that this is critical to making it happen. Just yesterday, Chief U.S. District Judge Jerry Rosen, who's the lead federal mediator, met with the foundations, and one of the messages he told them is this fund is critical to making this happen, and without it, the deal collapses.
And are the foundations, are they still in the game?
Foundations are in the game. Mm-hmm. Foundations are looking for assurances that this thing is not going to get derailed. And my understanding is that Rosen told them he didn't think that it would, with the possible exception of an act of the legislature. Now, what's going on behind the scenes is that the governor's people and representatives of the majority leader and the House Speaker have pretty much laid out their plan about how they think they can get this thing passed. And so there's some degree of comfort behind the scenes that this is going to happen. But out front, you've got a lot of members expressing publicly skepticism about this, which you would expect in an election year.
Sure enough. And then as for the pension funds, there's the other question. But can you really fault them for waiting to see if the Sixth Circuit tosses out Judge Rhodes' ruling that the federal bankruptcy trumps that state constitution clause?
No, you can't fault them. And I think you would expect that they would do that. They have to show to their pensioners that they have every mile, if not extra miles, to see if that is upheld. That said, I think the feeling behind the scenes and what I'm hearing from people that have talked to legal types that have vetted this, and it's been vetted at very high levels, is there's a very strong belief that the Sixth Circuit will not uphold the pension protections.
Oh, boy.
And that they will find that the pensions can be diminished.
Okay. And
As contracts. In a federal bankruptcy proceeding, that's a very important point for people to understand, is that Judge Rhodes is essentially saying, look, once you get into federal bankruptcy, the protections no longer apply because these are deemed as contracts. And we throw out modified contracts all the time in bankruptcy.
This is truly case precedent that's going to be looked at from coast to coast, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any question. And frankly, a lot of what's going on here in the bankruptcy is precedent-setting. It's precedent-setting in terms of how Kevin Orr wants to treat general obligation bondholders and essentially treat them as unsecured creditors. It's precedent-setting in terms of how they would deal with pension protections in a state constitution. And Michigan is not the only state in the union that has a constitutional protections for pensions.
Right.
So this has a lot of application. Now, I think the perverse thing that's happening here, some people will say, well, this is going to push a lot of cities to want to look at Chapter 9. I think you could make the opposite argument and say it's going to push a lot of cities to say, we don't want to go there.
Mm.
And state governments also to say, we need to have a more robust system to help troubled cities before they have to get to that point. Because it becomes a contentious and expensive and embarrassing prospect for a major city in any state to have to go through this.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
If you like to hunt or fish in Michigan, heads up. There's a new fee system that's kicking in on Saturday. It's the first significant hike in hunting and fishing fees in over 15 years. Here to tell us just what's new and what the increase goes towards is Ed Golder of the Michigan DNR. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Cynthia. How are you?
Good. So it is the first increase since 1997. Why such a long spell?
Well, I think there was not consensus within the conservation community about how to move forward with potential changes. And really, it took a while to build that consensus. But when we finally did, we really got a lot of people behind this new hunting and fishing license structure. And I want to go back just a little bit, if I could, and just kind of build the framework for what we're talking about here. You mentioned hunters and anglers at the top of our interview, and that's absolutely true. This will affect them. But hunting and fishing really does fund conservation in Michigan. So that's the important thing to keep in mind, that even if you're just going in the woods to walk on a beautiful fall day, or you're going out on the big lake to go sailing and never throw a line in the water, this hunting and fishing restructuring will benefit you in that it'll add additional revenues for natural resources management across Michigan. The average taxpayer through general tax dollars pays about half a penny a day for natural resources management. Most of it is done by hunters and anglers and the fees they pay in licenses and the taxes they pay for hunting and fishing equipment. So this really is a great day for everybody in that sense.
And the way the collection fees, I see that somewhere around $20 million a year this new fee structure should generate.
Right. We're thinking about $18 million in the first full year of implementation. Yep.
And I see broad-based funding. So tell us how that differs from the way it worked before.
Well, what you're referring to there is a new structure on the hunting side. So one of the things that this whole system does is makes the license structure for hunting and fishing in Michigan more simple, fair, and efficient. So before, when we went and looked at the number of licenses we have in Michigan, there were about 227 different types of licenses, which is kind of a daunting number when you think about it. And we thought, we can make this simpler. And so we got it down to just over 40. In doing that, we looked at the structure of hunting licenses in particular, and one of the things we did was add what's called a base license. Now, this is something that's done in other states. We hadn't done it here, but that base license really provides broad-based funding for natural resources in Michigan, especially wildlife habitat, obviously. Whereas, typically, deer licenses, a portion of that will go to deer habitat.
Okay.
Turkey licenses, a portion will go to turkey habitat. This base license, which also allows you to hunt small game, and it's called a base because you have to buy that in order to get a deer license or a turkey license or a bear license. That base license will go toward all kinds of habitat work across the state.
And that's $11 once a year.
It is.
Give us a sense, without getting into all 42 different fee categories and the licensing options, deer hunting is obviously something that is a major part of being outdoors in Michigan for many folks.
Right,
so
absolutely.
Give us an idea of what the new deer licenses are going to cost.
Yeah, so first of all, you'll buy that base license, right? So you'll pay that $11, and then you'll buy a $20 deer license. And before, we had deer licenses for distinct seasons, for the archery season, for the firearm season, for the muzzleloader season. Now, really, that same license will carry you across all those seasons. So that's how it's more simple, fair, and efficient in that sense.
Well, I have to say, it's nice to just discuss this and realize that someday this winter's going to end, and we will be out in the summertime and be on a Michigan lake that isn't frozen. So for people who don't love ice fishing, there will someday be a way to enjoy pure Michigan again.
That is the hope, isn't it? Yeah, no, I think spring will be here before we know it. We'll be selling fishing licenses. People will be out there in the outdoors again, because this really, those resources really define who we are as Michiganders, I think.
You can see the new license structure. Just go to the DNR website, michigan.gov/DNR, and Ed Golder is with the state DNR. Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
How do we keep our smart, energetic, bright college graduates from packing up and leaving Michigan? Well, here's one way: by helping those with an entrepreneurial spirit launch their startups in Michigan. That's the idea behind a contest called the Michigan Collegiate Innovation Prize. More than 81 teams from more than 16 colleges and universities around the state apply to be a part of this contest. At stake, more than $100,000 in prizes and intensive startup training. Joining me now is Amy Klinke with the U of M Center for Entrepreneurship. It's in the College of Engineering, and she's the contest director. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Hello, thank you.
And we welcome a member of one of the winning teams, Dr. Mark Keel, a pathology resident at the University of Michigan Hospital. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Amy, what was the overall point of the Michigan Collegiate Innovation Prize?
Well, this program actually started 5 years ago, and just like a startup, we have had many iterations over the last 5 years. We started actually out of the business school as just a clean energy prize, and it was just a business plan competition, okay, which was great. But one of the things that we noticed when we were doing this is that we had 25 teams enter and only three win. And those three teams may or may not have moved on to create a venture. And what we realized that if we did some training with those other 22 teams, mm-hmm, that we might actually get all of them to be ventures, or at least give them the training to do that if it wasn't for that topic for another venture. So that was the next 2 years, same thing, focused on training and just clean energy. And this year, we were able to iterate one more time where we took we expanded all the categories from just clean energy, but to include web and IT and healthcare and product and services.
So you really spread out.
Yeah. We decided that, you know, we were really limiting the opportunities for our students. And so we broadened it, as well as the Center for Entrepreneurship had been participating in a program called the National I-Corps Program, which, similar to the Peace Corps, mm-hmm, I-Corps stands for innovation. And it's an intensive training program originally only for researchers at universities with National Science Foundation funding. And we were able to take that training and give it to all of these students, undergrads as well.
So you had some 81 teams from more than 16 colleges and universities applying to be a part of this contest. Give us an idea of some of the kinds of projects that were submitted.
Oh, my goodness. we had anything from a team that decided they wanted to It was in the energy category, and they were going to make a hybrid tree seed with glowworms or fireflies, and then that would make the trees glow at night, and that would be a different way to light, which I thought was an interesting idea.
Chemiluminescent trees.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we had a lot of kind of crazy but kind of cool ideas like that that came in. The teams that actually got accepted, so out of 81 teams, we only accepted 29. And the teams that got accepted were really based on the quality of the idea, the passion of the students. Do they have the right team members to do it? So if your idea is web-based, do you have a programmer on your team? Mm-hmm. Knowing that and also the passion and tenacity of the students.
Well, Dr. Mark Keel, your team, Genomenon, I love that name, was one of the winners. So tell us about the technology you presented for this project.
So basically it's software that simplifies genome sequencing interpretation. So that's complicated for people not in the field. Basically, a genome is all the 3 billion letters of DNA that make us who we are. And sometimes even a single change in one of those letters can mean the difference between health and disease. So it used to be that physicians in the laboratory would look for those changes one at a time.
Oh, boy.
But recent technological advances have made it possible that we could sequence all 3 billion in a couple of days for a couple $100. So the problem is that analyzing all that data is very challenging. And what we do is automate and simplify that process for physicians in the laboratory.
Which is something that truly would have the possibility to save lives around the world.
So particularly in the case of cancer, where the difference in going from unknown to a diagnosis, if it takes more than a couple days or weeks, it can mean the difference, yeah, between a bad outcome and a positive outcome for the patient.
And how about the training, this I-Corps training and the idea that you're getting some tools?
So it's impossible to underestimate how important this training was. I was pretty aware that we had something that was commercially viable while we were working on it because we were solving our own problems. Mm-hmm. And if we in our research laboratory and clinical laboratory were having these problems, we assumed that it was true of all these other laboratories across the nation and throughout the world. And so after dawning on us that this was a potential business model, we realized that we didn't know anything about starting. And so I
your doctors. You had a lot of medical school to wade through.
We know the science, and we know the relevance to medicine, but we don't know how to make it a reality in the business realm. And so the MCIP, I have to say, was one of our first forays into making this a reality. And it's taken us from being very naive, I feel like, to at least knowing the lay of the land and understanding what's required to move forward in the next steps. So outside of the training, there's a great deal of exposure to the business community in Ann Arbor. There's mentorship that you're linked up with, and I have to say that in our case in particular, the mentorship that we were joined with was very helpful.
So what are your hopes for the company?
Well, to make it a success.
Yes.
And I feel like in no small part due to the MCIP, we're well on our way. So to make it a success, to put our product in the hands of customers, to, you know, the goal here is to change the way that medicine is conducted. And we feel like, given the newness of this technology and the struggles associated with making it a clinical reality, we feel like we're in a really good position to do just that.
Amy, give us a sense of how you hope that this contest would help keep talent in Michigan.
So the idea is that we took the business plan competition model and blew it out and said, okay, let's focus on the people in the program and train them to start a business. So the idea is that they get connected, as Mark just said, to the community, to the corporate connections, to mentors, that when they start their business or if they go work with another business, that they're going to do it here in the state, right? Because we're now exposing them to the entire entrepreneurial ecosystem across the state. So we partnered with our friends in Grand Rapids, in Kalamazoo, in the UP, in Mount Pleasant. And the whole idea was to plug them in so that when these students graduate, no matter where they're coming from, they're connected with our community. And I think when you're connected to a community, you're much more likely to stay.
We are excited about Genomenon and what
we're
going to be doing. Yes. And I think there could be really, when you think about a breakthrough that could save lives when battling cancer, this is terrific. And it's great to know that it came right out of your energies and the prize, the Michigan Collegiate Innovation Prize. I've been speaking with Amy Klinke, who's director of the prize, and with her was a member of one of the winning teams, Dr. Mark Keel, pathology resident at the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Tony Brown. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let us talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.